to Season 2 of the Melody Mystery and Mayhem Podcast. We can't wait to share this new season of 10 brand new episodes with you. We have lots of changes this season, don't we, Annalise?
Yes, we do, Madeline.
First off, we wanted to reintroduce ourselves for any new listeners to our podcast. My name is Madeline, and I'm the oldest.
My name is Sophia, and I'm the second born.
My name is William. I'm the only boy besides Daddy in the family.
My name is Annalise, and I'm the baby sister.
Well, that's enough chit-chat for now. Let's jump right into one of the most exciting parts of Season 2. Da-da-da-da! We have a theme song! William, do you want to tell our listeners about it?
Yes, I would love to. Our theme song for Season 2 is King Alfred's War Chant.
This was a chant written back in the 9th century during the time of, you guessed it, King Alfred. King Alfred the Great defended his people, the Anglo-Saxons, against the Danes and is well known in history as a great social and educational reformer. He also was a great believer and defender of the Christian faith.
Can we get on to the music now?
Yes, sweetie. It's high time we got to our theme song. Our hope is that by the end of Season 2, every single parent and child listening to the podcast will have King Alfred's war chant memorized. And our many thanks to Mr. Nathan Clark George and Mr. Henry Hafner, who arranged the music and recorded instruments and vocals for us. Now, on to the war chant!
Our favorite family activities, Daddy Read Aloud Time. Today, our daddy will be reading a story called The Adventure of Grizel Cochran by Arthur Quiller Couch.
In the summer and autumn of 1685, the toll booth held prisoners enough, notwithstanding the many gloomy processions that were from time to time walking to the axe and halter in the grass market. And in a narrow cell, late one August evening, two persons were sitting of whom this story shall treat. These two were Sir John Cochrane of Ochiltree and his daughter Grizel, here on the status of errands to visit her father in prison and help in his preparations for death. For Sir John, a stout Whig, had been one of the leaders of Argyle's insurrection, had been beaten with his troops by Lord Ross at Murdyke's, had disbanded his handful of men, and fled for hiding to the house of his uncle, Mr. Gavin Cochrane, of Cragmere, had been informed against by his uncle's wife, seized, taken to Edinburgh, had been paraded, bound, and bareheaded through the streets by the common executioner, and then on the 3rd of July flung into the toll booth to await his trial for high treason, and now the trial too was over, and Sir John was condemned to die. As he now sat with bowed head on the bench of his cell, it was not the stroke of death that terrified him, for Sir John was a brave man, but the parting with his children. Who would, though his rashness be left, both orphaned and penniless, for the crown would seize his goods, and chiefly the parting of his daughter, who had been his one comfort in the dark days of waiting for the king's warrant of execution to arrive. Between his apprehension and his trial, no friend or kinsman had been allowed to visit him, but now that his death was assured, greater license had been granted. But anxious to deprive his enemies of a chance to accuse his sons, he had sent them his earnest entreaties and commands that they should abstain from using this permission until the night before his execution. They had obeyed, but obedience of this sort did not satisfy the conscience of his daughter, Grizel. On the very night of his condemnation, he heard the key turn in his door. Thinking it could only be the gaoler, he scarcely lifted his eyes. But the next moment a pair of soft arms were flung around his neck, and his daughter was weeping on his breast. From that day she continued to visit him, and now, as she sat beside him, staring at the light already fading in the narrow pane, both father and daughter knew that it was almost the last time. Presently she spoke.
"And this message, tell me truly, have you any hope from it?"
"It was an appeal made by Sir John's father, the Earl of Dunderall, to Father Peters, the king's confessor, who often dictated to him, as well known on matters of the state. But in the short time left, would there be time to press this appeal, and exert the influence in London which alone could stay the death warrant?"
"There is no hope in that quarter," said Sir John.
Grizel knew that he spoke only what was her own conviction and her despair.
"Argyle is dead these 3 days," pursed her father, "and with him men of less consequence than I. Are they likely to spare me ahead of the rising? Would they spare any man now in the heat of their revenge?"
"Father," said Grizel suddenly, "could you spare me from your side for a few days?"
Sir John looked up. He knew by her manner that she had formed some plan in her mind. He knew, too, from her heart that nothing but chance of winning his safety could take her from him now, of all times.
"My child," he said, "you are going to attempt something."
She nodded, with a brighter face than she had worn for many days.
"And what would you attempt?" he went on. "Is an impossibility."
"Nothing is impossible to a true heart," she said.
"And who will help you?"
"No one."
She was standing before him now, and in the twilight he could see her eyes lit up with hope, her figure upright, and as it full of a man's strength.
"My girl, you will run into danger, into blame. They will not spare you, and do you know the characters of those men whom you would have to sue?"
She bent and kissed him.
"I am a Cochrane, my father."
Early next morning, before the world was up, Grizel Cochrane was mounted on horseback and riding towards the border. She had dressed herself, this girl of 18, as a young serving woman, and when she drew rein at the wayside cottage for food and drink, professed herself journeying on a borrowed horse to visit her mother's house across the Tweed. By noon, Edinburgh was some leagues behind, but she pressed on through that day and most of the following night. On the second day, after leaving Edinburgh, she crossed the Tweed,
and came in safely to the home of an old nurse on the English side, 4 miles beyond the town of Berwick.
"Good sakes!"
cried the old woman, who was standing at her cottage door and was rather astonished to find the horsewoman drawn rein, lip to the ground, and plant a kiss on either cheek.
"Good sakes! If it isn't Miss Grizel!"
"Quickly, into the house!" commanded the young mistress. "I have somewhat to tell that will not wait an hour."
She knew the old nurse was to be trusted, and therefore told her story of her secret.
"Even now," she said at the end of her story, "the postman is riding from London with a warrant in his bag. I must stop him and make him give it up to me, or my father's head is the penalty."
"But what use of talk of this, when the postman is a stout rider, and I'm to boot? How is a mere girl saving your presence to do it all?"
"Look here."
Grizel unrolled a bundle in which she had brought on her saddle crutch from Edinburgh, and it held a horseman's cloak and a brace of pistols.
"Now," she said, "where are the clothes of Donald, my foster brother? He was a slight lad in time's sign, and little doubt they will fit me."
For this was indeed the brave girl's plan. In those times the mail from London took 8 days in its journey to Edinburgh. By possessing herself of the warrant for her father's death and detaining it, she could count on the delay of 16 or 17 days at least before the application could be made for a second, and that signed and sent to the Scotch capital. By this delay, time enough would be won for her friends in London to use all their influence to quash the sentence. It was a mad scheme, but, as she had said, nothing is impossible to a true heart. She had possessed herself, too, of the minutest information in regard to the places where the postmen rested on their journey. One of these places, she knew, was a small inn by a widow on the outskirts of the little town of Belford. There the man who received the bag at Durham was accustomed to arrive at 6 in the morning, and take a few hours' sleep before going on with his journey. And at Belford, Grizel Cochrane had determined to meet him. Taking leave of her faithful nurse, she rode southwards again, and, timing her pace, drew up before the inn of Belford just an hour after the postman had come in from the south and disposed himself to sleep. The mistress of the inn had no ostler, so Grizel stabled her horse with her own hands, and, striding into the inn parlour, demanded food and drink.
"Sit down, ye then," answered the old woman, "at the end of the table, for the best I have to give to you is all ready. And be pleased, my bonny man, to make as little noise as may be, for there's one asleep in that bed that I like ill to disturb."
She pointed to the victuals on the board, which were indeed the remains of the sleeping man's meal. Grizel sat down before them, considered to herself while she played with a mouthful of two, and then asked,
"Can I have a drink of water?"
"'Deed," answered the hostess, "and are ye a water drinker? 'Tis but an ill custom for a change house."
"Why, that I know, and so, when I put up at an inn, 'tis my custom always to pay for it the price of stronger drink, which I cannot take."
"Indeed, well, that's fairly spoken, and, come to think of it, 'tis but just."
The landlady brought the jug of water and set it on the board.
"Is the well where you get this water near at hand?"
said Grizel, pouring out a glass and sipping at it.
"For if it's no trouble to fetch me some more, I will tell you that this is rather overwarm and flat. Your trouble shall be considered in the drawing," she added.
"'Tis a good step off," answered the dame, "but I cannot refuse to fetch for so civil, discreet a lad, and a well-favored one besides. So bid ye hear, and I'll be as quick as a man. But for any sake, take care and don't meddle with the man's pistols there, for they are loaded, the both, and every time I set eyes on them, they scare me out of my senses almost."
She took up the pitcher and went out to draw the water. No sooner was Grizel left alone than, starting up, she waited for a moment, listening to the footsteps as they died away in the distance, and then crept swiftly across the floor to the place where the postman lay asleep. He lay in one of those closed wooden bedsteads, like cupboards, which were then common in the houses of the poor, and to this day may be seen in many a house in Brittany. The door of it was left half open to give the sleeper air, and from this aperture the noise of his snoring issued in a way that shook the house. Nevertheless, it seemed to the girl that he must be awakened by the creaking of the floor underneath the light footfall. With heart and mouth she stole up to the bedstead, and gently pulling on the door still wider ajar, peeped in, and in hope of seeing the mailbag, and being able to pounce upon it. She saw it indeed, but to her dismay it lay beneath the shaggy head of its guardian, a giant in size. The postman used his charge as a pillow, and had flung himself so heavily across it to give not a faintest hope that anyone could pull it away without disturbing its keeper from its nap. Nothing could be done. In those few bitter moments during which she stood helplessly looking from the bag which contained the fatal warrant to the unconscious face of the man before her, Grizel made up her mind to another plan. She turned to the table, caught up the postman's holsters, and pulled out the pistols of which the old woman had professed herself in such terror. Quickly drawing and secreting the charges, she returned them to their cases, with many an anxious look over her shoulder towards the bedstead, and took her seat again at the foot of the table. Hardly had she done so when she heard the old woman returning with the pitcher. Grizel took a draught, for her throat felt like a lime kiln, and having settled on her bill, much to the landlady's satisfaction, by paying for the water the price of a pot of beer, prepared to set off. She carelessly asked and ascertained how much longer the other guest was likely to sleep.
"By the noise that he makes, he intends sleeping till doomsday," she said, laughing. "Ay, poor man, his is a hard life," said the hostess, "and little more than half an hour more before he must be on the highway again."
Grizel laughed once more, and mounting her horse, set off on a trot along the road southward, as if continuing her journey in that direction. Hardly had she got beyond the town, however, when, turning the horse's head, she galloped back, making a circuit around Belford and striking into a high road again between the place and Berwick. Having gained it, she walked the horse gently on, awaiting the coming up of the postman. Though all her mind was now set on the enterprise before her, she could not help a shiver of terror if she thought on chance of her tampering with the pistols being discovered and their loading replaced. But she had chosen her course, and now she must go through with it. She was a woman, after all, and it cannot be wondered that her heart began to beat quickly as her ear caught the sound of hoofs on the road behind her, and turning, she saw the man on whose face she had been gazing not an hour before, trotting briskly towards her. The mail bags, there were two, one containing the letters from London, the others taken up at the different post offices on the road, strapped one on each side of his saddle in front, close to the holsters. At the last moment her nerve came back, and as he drew near she saluted him civilly, with perfect calmness, put her horse into the same pace with his, and rode on for some way into the company. The postman was a burly, thick-set man with a good-humored face. You may be sure that Miss Corcoran inspected it anxiously enough, and was relieved to find it did not contain any vast amount of hardy courage. The man was well enough inclined for conversation, too, and as they rode had a heap of chat, which it seemed a pity to interrupt. At length, however, when they were about halfway between Belford and Berwick, Grizel judged now or never was the time. Pulling her horse's rein gently so as to bring her close to her company, she said in a low but
perfectly determined voice, "Friend, I have taken a fancy for those mailbags of yours, and I must have them. Therefore take my advice and deliver them up quietly, for I am provided for all hazards. I am mounted, as you see, on a fleet horse. I carry firearms, and moreover, I am allied with those who are stronger, though not bolder, than I. You see that wood yonder?"
she continued, pointing to about 1/2 mile off, with an accent and air meant to corroborate her bold words.
"Then take my advice. Give me up your bags, and speed back the road you came from the present. Nor dare to approach that wood for at least 2 or 3 hours to come."
The postman, whose eyes had been growing rounder and rounder during the speech from the stripling beside him, pulled up and looked at her in dumb amazement for some moments.
"Hilf," said he, as soon as he found his tongue. "You mean, master, to make yourself merry at my expense? You are heartily welcome. I could see a joke, I trust, as well as another man. So have your laugh out, and don't think that I'm one to take offense at the words of a foolish boy. But if—" and here he whipped a pistol from his holster and turned the muzzle onto her face— "if you're mad enough to think seriously of such business, then I'm ready for you." They had come to a stand now, in the middle of the road, and Grizel felt an ugly sinking in the heart as she looked at the mouth of the pistol, now not a yard from her cheek. Nevertheless, she answered, very quietly and coolly,
"If you have a doubt, dismiss it. I am quite in earnest."
The postman, with his hand on the trigger, hesitated.
"Methinks, my lad, you seem of an age when robbing a garden or an old woman's fruit stall would befit you better. If you so be must turn thief, then taking his majesty mails upon his highway from a stout and grown man. So be thankful, then. You have met with one who will not shed blood if you can help it. And go to your way before I am provoked to fire."
"Sir," said Goodwill, "you are a worthy man, nor am I fonder of bloodshed than you. But if you will not be persuaded, then what shall I do? For I have said, and it is the truth, that mail I must and will have. Choose, then."
And with this she pulled out a pistol from under her cloak, and, cocking it, presented it in his face.
"Nay, then, your blood be on your own head," cried the postman, and raising his pistol again, he pulled the trigger, and it flashed in the pan. Dashing the weapon to the ground, he pulled out another in a moment, and aiming it in Grizel's face, fired, with the same result. In a furious passion, he flung down the pistol, sprang from his horse, and dashed forward to seize her. She dug in her spurs in her horse's flank, and just eluded his grasp. Meanwhile, the postman's horse, frightened at the noise and the struggle, had moved forward a pace or two. The girl saw her opportunity, and seized it at the same instant. Another dig with her spurs, and her own horse was level with the other. Leaning forward, she caught at the bridle, and, calling at the pair an instant, was galloping off on the highway, leaving the postman helplessly staring. She had gone about 100 yards with her prize when she pulled up to look back. Her discomfited antagonist was still standing in the middle of the road, apparently stupefied with amazement at the unlooked-for turn of affairs that had taken. Shouting to him to remember her advice about the wood, she put both the horses to their speed, and on looking back once more was gratified to find the postman, impressed with the truth of her mysterious threat, and he had turned and was making the best of his way back to Belford. On gaining the woods to which she had pointed, Grizel tied the postman's horse to a tree at a safe distance from the road, and set out about unfastening the straps of the mailbags. With a sharp penknife she ripped them open, and searched for the government dispatches among their contents.
To find these was not difficult, owing their address in the council in Edinburgh, and of the imposing weight of their seals. Here she discovered not only the warrant for her father's death, but also many other sentences inflicting punishment in varying degrees on the unhappy men who had been taken in the late rising. Time was pressing. She could not stop to examine these warrants, but, quickly tearing them in small pieces, placed them carefully in her bosom. This done, and having arranged all the private papers as far as possible as she had found them, Grizel mounted her horse again and rode off. The postman's horse and the mailbags, she imagined, would soon be found, and from hence she had given the man about the wood, and this afterwards proved to be the case. She now set her horse in a gallop again, and did not spare whip nor spur until she reached the cottage of her nurse, where her first care was to burn not only the warrant of her father's death, but the remainder of sentences and his fellow prisoners. Having satisfied herself that all trace of the obnoxious papers was now consumed, she put on again her female garments, and was once more the gentle and unassuming Miss Grizel Cochrane. It was high time, however, to be making her way northwards again. Accordingly, she left her pistols and cloak to be concealed by the nurse, and after set forward on her journey. By avoiding the high road, resting only at the most sequestered cottages, and then but for an hour or so, and riding all the while as hard as she might, she reached Edinburgh in safety early next morning. It remains only to say that in time, thus won by this devoted girl, was enough to gain the end for which she strove, and Father Peters plied the ear of King James so well, and at such a length, that the order signed for John Cochrane's pardon was complete. The state of public affairs rendered it prudent for many years that this action of Grizel Cochrane's should be kept secret, but after the Revolution, when men could speak more freely, her heroism was known and applauded. She lived to marry Mr. Kerr of Morriston in Berwickshire, and doubtless was as good a wife as she had proved herself a daughter.
Next up is our new music. Special thanks to Patrick and Molly Lockwood for leading the melody portion of the podcast. For episode 1, we will be singing Oh How I Love Jesus. If you'd like to follow along and learn the lyrics, all the songs for season 2, including King Alfred's War Chant, are located on the website melodymysterymayhem.com.
To hear, I love to sing its word. It sounds like music in my ear, the sweetest name on earth. Oh, how I love Jesus! Oh, how I love Jesus! Oh, how I love Jesus! Because he first loved me. Tells me of a Savior's love who died to set me free. It tells me of his precious blood, a sinner's perfect plea. Oh, how I love Jesus! Oh, how I love Jesus! Oh, how I love Jesus! Because he first loved me. It tells of one whose loving heart can feel my deepest woe, who in each sorrow bears a part that none can bear below. Oh, how I love Jesus! Oh, how I love Jesus! Oh, how I love Jesus! because he first loved me.
And now, on to a new segment of the podcast called The Life and Times of Literal Larry. We decided to create this segment because our brother William is the most literal person we know. We suspect that we're not the only family out there with a literal Larry, so we are hoping some of you might identify with some of the great frustrations and great hilarity that comes with an obsessively literal person in your family.
Hello, this is Violet Quill, news reporter of the Providence Gazette. I'm interviewing an extraordinary character today named Literal Larry. Say hello to our audience, Larry.
Hi. I'm a little nervous about this.
Oh, don't worry. It's a piece of cake.
Really?
Why, yes.
Can I eat it now?
What? Sure, later. Well, anyway, Larry, do you have any siblings?
Yes, three sisters.
I bet it's hard not to drive them crazy with you being so literal.
No, I can't reach the pedals yet.
Huh? Well, what do you like to do, Larry?
Build things.
Like Legos?
Yes.
Well, do you feel it is high time for you to do something about being so literal?
People say time flies, but I never knew it could jump.
Oh, you are literal, Larry. My sides are splitting with laughter.
Oh, no, I didn't mean to. Should we call an ambulance? Help, somebody help!
No, please, Larry, no. We should wrap this up, since you take everything so seriously.
Oh, okay.
Well, listeners, the interview is over, and for some reason, Larry is covered with wrapping paper and duct tape. I guess I need to go find some scissors to help him unwrap. Back to you in the studio, Bob!
This season, we plan to conclude each episode with a poetry recitation. Today, my sister and I will be reciting what is called a poem for two. The title is Honeybees, and the author is Paul Fleischman.
Being a bee is a joy.
Is a pain.
I'm a queen.
I'm a worker.
I'll gladly explain. Upon rising, I'm fed by my royal attendants.
I'm up at dawn guarding the hive's narrow entrance.
I'm bathed.
Then I take out the hive's muddy trash.
Then I'm groomed.
Then I put in an hour making wax without 2 minutes time to sit still and relax.
The rest of my day is quite simply set forth.
Then I might collect nectar from the field 3 miles north.
I lay eggs.
Or perhaps I'm on larva detail.
By the hundred.
Feeding the grubs in their sails, wishing I were still helpless and pale.
I'm loved and I'm lauded. I'm outranked by none.
Then I pack combs with pollen. Not my idea of fun.
When I've done enough laying,
then weary I strive.
I retire.
To patch up any cracks in the hive.
For the rest of the day.
Then I build some new cells, slaving away at enlarging this dungeon, dreading the sight of another sunrise, wondering why we don't all unionize.
Truly, a bee is the worst of all lives.